You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lillian Hanley tōku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Thursday, the 26th of March, our first day in lockdown, or what I'm going to be calling Rāhui from now on. My name is Lillian and I'll be with you for the next hour. This is obviously usually Mary Margaret Slack's Wire. Don't worry, you will still hear from her. Yes, indeed, in our first day of Rāhui, and the entire news team is off-site, so they are bringing you content from their homes. But I am interested to know what this is looking like for you, for all our listeners. Please do get in touch, let us know what your morning has been like, what you have planned for the day, perhaps the weekend. Are the days the same for you? Are they very different? What does it look like? Tuku pātū, Mike, and text us on 5395. Wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. I will answer where I can, and we can just have a chat, because, yeah, that is just me in here and you guys out there. On the show today, though, I have spoken to Stacey Morrison about a post she put up on Twitter with a saying from Ngā Pepeha a Ngā Tipuna, and we talk through the concept of rāhui, so you'll understand that better if you haven't heard it yet after that piece. Mary Margaret will have her weekly catch-up with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Kounaitis. This week they touch on the differing situations in different states across Australia. We will hear from Labor's Andrew Little once again and hear what police patrols might look like. And Rachel reports on the history of pandemics and epidemics in New Zealand. So you hear some audio from Archive, I believe. Looking forward to that. Don't forget you can catch all these stories and interviews online after the show. They'll be up as podcasts. Just go to 95bfm.com. I guess we should get into it.
The Wire.
Yes. Buttons. All right. To start us off today, I wanted to play this little clip Mary Margaret sent in, which is actually from Tuesday. So it is prior to the 11:59 Rāhui cutoff time. She had come across a local restaurant in her neighbourhood giving away free food, I believe, in the lead up to the lockdown. The restaurant is Flying Rickshaw, and Mary Margaret speaks to the owner, whose name is Netin Cutter. She started by asking him how soon after the announcement was made on Monday regarding a lockdown did they decide to give out the food.
This was yesterday, so we were closed yesterday as well for the dine-in or takeaway service. But, you know, we as a restaurant, we would always had enough food right. for our evening, and so I thought we might as well make it and give it away instead of, you know, just tell the community. And yeah,
that's so kind. I work as a waitress as well, and obviously everyone knows like how much the hospitality industry will suffer. Yes. From the lockdown. What compelled you to do that amidst all of that struggle?
I think we are all in together, as we say, and everybody is suffering, and I think yes, hospitality is going to suffer. I mean, as long as I think there's people are fine, I think that's more important for me as well as than anything else. And government has got a wage package, so I'm quite happy that my staff's going to have a wage. I've spoken to the landlord if he can give us some time to pay rent, and everything else can wait, you know. So it's I mean, if you manage your expenses properly, I think we should survive, and, you know, and see another day.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. And where are you planning to be during the lockdown?
Oh, just stay home, because I got two young kids and yeah. My mum lives with me as well.
Okay.
So rather be safe than anything else. Yeah, stay home, really.
Lovely. Yeah. And just one last question. What different curries are out on the table right now?
Well, we made some chicken curry and some vegan potato, and it's all gone in 5 minutes. So we had some biryani, which is gone as well. So my chefs are just making some more stuff so that we can put it out, because we did put on a local Devonport page that people can come and have some curry. So I don't want them come now and there's nothing there. So we're still making some more food, yeah. I mean, we didn't anticipate it's going to go that quick, but yeah.
That's so nice of you. Good on you guys. Awesome.
There has indeed been a lot of incredibly selfless actions taking place in the lead up to the Rahui and in the past few weeks as well. Of course, we have also had panic buying and people not thinking of others in that way, but it is good to remember that these acts of kindness are happening. I believe Satya was also giving away free food last night until their stocks ran out. So shout out to all of those people doing that. Again, if you have heard of any of these sorts of actions or stories like this, please let us know. It would be good to bring attention to them. Now, on to our first interview.
Māori grievances about land are historical. We didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, you know, started demanding our things back.
The Wire. Stacey Morrison is a broadcaster and author. She also noted that people call her a te reo Māori advocate, but she says, aren't we all? Yesterday, I came across a whakatauki that seemed very pertinent at this particular time. It reads, ka ora pea o ia koe, ka ora koe ia o. The English of this is, perhaps I will survive because of you, and you survive because of me. I thought this was a really good place to start our first Wire in the lockdown period, which I think I am going to be calling a rahui from now on. Stacey will explain. I started by asking how her whānau is going this morning.
I can just see my brother and his partner doing a workout outside right now, and my whānau are very much whakangungu people, and so if they don't have a workout, then there will be issues. But currently we're all good, and I've got a son who's got a hard out online school timetable, another one who's pretending that she is, and the other one's looking after the baby. So eight of us in our bubble.
Wow, awesome. Yeah. Hey, that's amazing and cool that, yeah, you guys are still doing the things that you're enjoying or maybe not enjoying with schoolwork.
Actually, the structure is probably good, because then, you know, 13 years old, you get up and you are doing something. I find it really funny listening to them, and you go, sir, how do I put up my hand? You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, you've got to find the light moments. And I'm just worried that we've peaked too early with all our painting and craft. And my daughter's like, can I have another one? I'm like, no, we can't get it. Nah, it's all gone.
Okay, got to start rationing those supplies.
Yeah.
Hey, so I'm wanting to have a chat just because I saw this. Is it a kiwa or whakatauki? What are we talking here?
Whakatauki. So the whakatauki is ka ora pe au ia koe, ka ora koe iau. Perhaps I survive because of you and you survive because of me. So this is a kōrero tahiko. It's an old whakatauki, and that's actually what I love about it so much, is that it's in a book called Ngā Pepeha a Ngā Tipuna. And so it just shows that the ancient wisdom of our ancestors is so relevant, and that they knew what it was like to live through times like this. And they had this wisdom to go, yeah, these are the kind of things that we learn when we live through things like flu, pandemics, you know, because our people have been through that before, but also just in the way that Māori used to live and go, okay, well, in times of, you know, war and times of crisis, sometimes the person that we are relying on is someone who will then rely on us. So as we are in a situation where we are not going out in order to save each other, I just thought it was really relevant. And my friend Rachel Ka'ai Mahuta, she was reading, which is always another good thing to do while we're in this period, that beautiful book that probably everyone who ever did Māori studies has. That is Ngā Pepeha a Ngā Tipuna, and that's Ngā Moteatea. All of those books have such wisdom, and I just love seeing how Tupuna really knew so much about what it is to live in a state that is actually about regeneration and protecting us from either illness or war or all the things that they knew about.
Aye, and you're right, it is so relevant right at this moment, because that's what everyone is calling for, basically trying to, you know, get that kindness from others to be thinking about others, right? Because it might be that you are okay, but you could also pass this on to somebody else.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the scary thing about it, I think, is not knowing, as the Prime Minister said, just act as if you are positive because you don't know. So because of that, the act of staying home and not being in contact with new people shows that it's actually an act of aroha, which is love and compassion. Aroha is not just love, it's compassion as well. So it's compassion for our fellow people of Aotearoa.
Mm. And actually, I suppose, I mean, my understanding of aroha, right, if you break that down, it is about, it's also that physicalness of facing somebody, right, and sharing that breath. So how do we do that if we can't actually do that right now?
Yeah, I think that there's one good thing about social media. There's definitely some not good things about social media, but you can do it like that, and you can also, I guess, literally in terms of the hongi for a while now, we've been saying, actually another ancient act that our people used to do was to send a hongi from afar, and it's called ha mamau. So ha, as you say, means breath, mamau means from afar. So apparently, particularly in some iwi where we're quite spread out, say in Te Waipounamu, they'd do that. If you can see someone on the other side of a hill, you send your hongi from afar. So you don't actually touch your nose, but you put your, kind of like make a knuckle in front of your nose and you send it to someone, sending your ha, your breath of life to someone else, but not actually touching them.
Wow, there you go. Okay.
Well, I knew there was no answer.
So finally, I suppose there have been people referring to this lockdown period, or even just this kind of whole, the context that we're in, I suppose, and calling it a rahui. So would you be able to just explain what rahui is?
Well, my husband Scotty and I were talking about this. What we like about rahui is it kind of gives the context of rahui a place for a reason. So rahui recognise that there has been a trespass in some way, like there has either been a death or a mate, and we could say in this case illness or danger. And so due to that, we go into a different state to regenerate, to protect. And that's what rahui always do. So when you know, like, say, if someone dies at a swimming pool and then they put a rahui there, that's a recognition of, okay, we have had a death there, and we need to recognise that that space needs to be cleared and changed. And here we are recognising that with an illness, with this danger, we need to stay in a restricted state for our own well-being and ongoing survival.
Mm. Kia ora.
So kei te pai tēnā, geez, te reo Māori, eh?
We're yeah.
So lucky that we're so lucky that we have this wisdom and we have these terms, because lockdown doesn't really speak to me, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't inspire me.
It also kind of, I mean, for me anyway, I'm not sure if other people are feeling this, but it does invoke this kind of, I mean, it's seriousness is there, and I think that perhaps that is important, but it also kind of invokes, it's quite scary too.
Yeah, I mean, English is quite clinical in that way. Don't get me wrong, I love English as well, but it is quite clinical when you use terms like self-isolation and lockdown. And so in rahui, we're actually saying, yes, we are in a restricted time. We recognise that because we have a bigger picture of seeing there is a necessary need to take these actions, and the result will be regenerating and better for all.
Mm. And people, I mean, you know, when we normally use rahui, I suppose, or at least me, it's often referred to perhaps for the, you know, te taiao, for example, with Cody dieback happening, there's been a rahui in the Waitakere. And so, you know, how do we kind of consider what, I mean, yeah, I'm trying to, with the...
I know what you mean. Yeah,
well,
I mean... Because sometimes we have that connection with rahui as being just restriction, because I think we've missed the fact that there's a restriction for a reason, because we have realised that this is part of a cycle that will make us better in the end. And it's just like with the kauri, there is a rahui because there has been a trespass, and then there has been a mate that has been introduced, and so therefore the rahui will help things get better. So I guess it's about missing, usually we talk about it and we forget the part that says the rationale is for us to regenerate and for us to get better.
Mm. I don't know, that was a great place to end, so I might end it there if you don't want to go into this, but I just read, or somebody sent this thing, I think it's Nadine Ann Huda, she wrote on a spin-off, Rest Now, E Papa Tuanuku, as a poem, pointing to, you know, like we're in this kind of this moment, but it hasn't actually been necessarily for the taiao. That's kind of what I was getting at. It has been for tangata. So can you still apply it in that way?
Oh, definitely. Mm. Yeah, I mean, people would also have rahui on a person, you know, on a person if something happens to them. So you can definitely put it in that context of a person. And we often have ideas of people having to sit out a time because, you know, like say if you transgress and you know, then we often go, okay, there's a time where you need to be apart from whatever it is that you've made a mistake on, you know, something like that. If you've had a transgression or been bad to someone, then, you know, it's a similar sort of concept. I mean, I think this is a really Māori concept. In terms of the taiao, I think that we will... It's all interrelated, eh, as far as Māori are concerned anyway, but that this is perhaps an utu, maybe, you know, for what we've done to the taiao, but also that it gives Papatūānuku and all of the taiao a chance to catch up. I mean, look at all the smog that cleared in China. We will see Manu going different places and going, hey, this is cool. No one's here, you know. And I'm looking, you know, like I had a couple of, we always have tui at the back of our house, and I had a tiraitaka come and have a great big kōrero yesterday. So, you know, look for things that you will find soothing, but also that show that this does impact the taiao, and it kind of reminds us what we do every single day quite mindlessly without thinking about it. And maybe us being away from some environments is actually a good thing for the taiao.
That was Stacey Morrison. If you have any questions, please get in touch 5395 on the text machine and call us on 309-3879. We have had a text in from a community nurse who's driving their patients around. I wonder what that is like, fairly eerie out there on the roads with no one else on there. Possibly much safer, though, than normal driving. She says, or he says, thanks for the calming voices and sweet music. Stay home, stay safe. Yes, indeed.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
We now have our catch-up with Zoe Kunaitis from Radio Adelaide. None of us have actually seen Zoe in person before. We usually just do the interview over the phone, but this time Mary Margaret rang her over Skype and they got to have a proper moment of whakawhanaungatanga. They spoke about how Australians are managing to keep up with differing states of lockdown across the country and if citizens can expect more consistency in announcements and emergency planning from Scott Morrison anytime soon.
It seems that there's like a differing state of lockdown all over Australia. What's the situation over there? Are you actually in lockdown?
So there's been different states have taken different ways of going into lockdown. Essentially, Tuesday night, Scott Morrison did quite a big conference, press conference, with really unclear lockdown instructions, but states like Victoria and New South Wales have gone a bit harder. They've locked down all non-essentials. They've also shut schools in Victoria. They're the only state to have done so far. I feel like we're quite close to hearing more instructions and going into further lockdown. But Tuesday night's press conference was very confusing. So you can't have a funeral with more than five people or a wedding with more than five people, but all shops are going to be open. You can go to the hairdressers, but only for 30 minutes. Schools are still open, for example, in most places. Shops will be closed, but they'll be open. Cafes can only do takeaway. Food courts are closed, but big shopping malls are still open. It's really confusing. Scott Morrison's leadership at this time is so interesting. He's kind of not being very compassionate or very clear, which I think is creating a lot of panic within lots of people, a lot of confusion, and probably is diluting the seriousness of this, I think. It's not clear enough. Most Australians are staying home. Lots of people are working from home at the moment. But it's not an official lockdown, which I think creates a sense of complacency with perhaps some of the population not knowing whether they should be staying home or not. Oh, well, he has made it very clear to stay at home and there's a travel ban, but it still feels like an official lockdown would at least create some severity to...
Yeah. Do you feel worried about when you guys, I think it's fair to say, inevitably do go into full lockdown, that there will be like a lot of non-compliance?
I'm not sure. So I don't think so. We've had so a lot of people have been losing their jobs, right?
Mm.
And Australia has just, the government, sorry, have just announced a doubling of the welfare payments, which have been the same since 1994, right? Welfare payments are older than this in Australia. And I think that creates a bit of security for people who have lost their jobs and don't have to go out and try and find work. So it does create security for people in that sense. I mean, we saw just before these somewhat lockdowns in place, we saw Bindi Irwin getting married at Australia Zoo. I think she had a bit of a smaller ceremony because one of the rules was that weddings can only have 5 people, but that was going into effect midnight the night she got married. So I think she had a smaller ceremony at Australia Zoo. She wanted to get in before the rules kicked in.
We had the same issue here where inadvertently an impact of setting a time for the lockdown like means that people just rush in before that. And it's like the virus doesn't care that like when the lockdown officially starts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and to see public figures sort of doing it as well is a bit of a shame. And we had in Queensland, in Noosa, there was a 50th birthday party at a restaurant. I believe this was after the lockdown. Anyway, there's now something like 24 confirmed cases of coronavirus from this 50th birthday party in Noosa because they weren't listening. I'm hoping stories like this create, make people stay home because the proof is in the pudding. It's not funny, it's awful, but, you know, these people shouldn't have been where they were. So it's it really sucks for them, but this is probably a bit unempathetic, but at least it shows for the rest of the country what happens if you don't play by the rules.
Yeah. No, I think that it's a time where, like, we literally do have to lead by example and you do have to learn from the mistakes. So what's public response to ScoMo's leadership at the moment?
I guess it depends on who you ask, but a lot of people are very confused by everything he's saying. He is being quite aggressive with his announcements, and I mean, if we're honest, we're all kind of looking across the pond at you, your country, and Jacinta Ardern, and just her compassion and her empathy and her leadership in this time is really, it seems quite comforting. We were talking through Messenger and you were saying that you had a nervous excitement and that you were glad that the government was at least taking these strong actions and it made you feel comfortable. And then that resonated with me because I don't feel that at all.
Right.
I don't have that comfortability or that security from the government right now. I think because they're not being sort of harsh enough, it feels like it's left up to the individual to make sure we stay home, which is what we're doing. But I don't feel a lot of comfort from our leadership, and I think that's quite across the board.
Yeah,
it's pretty frightening at this time. By the weekend, or at least by next Monday, things will be quite different. They're doing a Australian-wide announcement today.
Well, we'll have to watch and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually a good point. The fact that the government haven't been strict enough or clear enough about lockdown or restrictions or requirements does leave a lot of businesses and a lot of people in the dark, especially employees and workers. A lot of people are confused. A lot of people don't know what the next 3 months are going to look like, or, you know, next however long is going to look like for them.
Mm.
That's a real consequence of the government.
That was Neighbourhood Watch Ripper.
That was indeed Neighbourhood Watch with Zoe Kunatis, and apologies for those background noises in that interview. We are still figuring out the best way of conducting interviews from home, as everybody is kind of stuck in one place and perhaps have other people around them continuing to do work or that sort of thing. We're going to be back shortly after this song by Unknown Mortal Orchestra, and we're going to hear about pandemics and epidemics in New Zealand history.
Wire.
Yes, you are tuned into The Wire. I am Lillian Hanley, and that song was called American Guilt by Unknown Mortal Orchestra. Sarah's laughing in the background. Why are you laughing, Sarah? I also just want you guys all to know that I squeezed some hand sanitizer onto my hands, obviously, just during that song, and I managed to kind of, the bottle sprayed all over the phone. So that's my life right now. Sorry, Rick. Okay, moving on to the next piece. This is by Rachel, and it is a look into the history of pandemics and epidemics in New Zealand and perhaps on how people dealt with it in the last century.
So I said, well, it's no use frightening ourselves into it. We must take every precaution and hope for the best. I used to disinfect the drains well and we gargled with a weak solution of Condis fluid every day. Tom used to spray the cars with formalin after taking patients to the hospital. It spread so fast that they had to put up a marquee to take the overflow of patients.
Here is a short history of how people lived through pandemics and epidemics in New Zealand's past. That was a town hall custodian's wife speaking about the 1918 influenza pandemic as it reached New Zealand's shores. Archival soundbites from nzhistory.govt.nz. The year was 1913, and Mormon missionary Richard Shumway travelled from Vancouver to Auckland to attend a hui with Māori from around the country. He believed he had measles, but in fact had smallpox, a disease which was, at the time, incurable. By the end of the year, 55 New Zealanders were killed by smallpox, all of them Māori. With the newspapers painting the disease as a Māori disease, politicians and public health officials used this misinformation to place harsh restrictions on Māori. Yellow flags were raised over Kāinga wherever a Māori fell ill. Māori in these areas were essentially barred from travelling unless they carried a certificate, and even then, public health officials would not take the certificate seriously. Ad hoc Pākehā militias stood by in some areas to enforce restrictions. Similar things were happening to Indigenous peoples across the British Empire. The year was 1918 and armistice was called to signal the end of World War II. But most New Zealanders, especially in rural communities, were thinking not so much of a war overseas and more so about the issue at home. The influenza.
In the midst of all this horror came the armistice, November 11, 1918. I recall the nearby church bell ringing and my father telling me the war was over. I was only vaguely interested. He told me that Bert, my brother, had died. I took as much interest.
That was the son of Reverend James McCaw of Lower Hutt. Caught up in the chaos of wartime, the New Zealand government couldn't react fast enough to the disease. In 2 months, New Zealand lost 9,000, about half as many people, to the influenza as it had in the whole of the First World War. No event has killed so many New Zealanders in such a short time. Central committees were established to coordinate relief efforts, and areas were divided into blocks or districts, each with its own depot or bureau. Not unlike today, many public facilities and businesses closed, and public events and gatherings were postponed. With the medical workforce already stretched due to the war, volunteers had to fill in the gaps, whether in their own household or in their local community.
And if anybody came into the hospital when we were desperate, they could even take a temperature or make a bed or a pulse or had any idea of nursing, we almost fell on their necks almost with gratitude because we didn't have to show them around, you see. We just said, get to it and look after them, you see. So ever since then, I've worked a good deal in the Red Cross, you see, in Hastings and Havelock. And my great idea is to get every girl trained that I could in this course of home nursing. We'll have epidemics again, we'll have emergencies again, probably.
That was a nurse from Hastings. Today, the remains living survivors of the polio outbreaks in the 1950s. With school closures and public gatherings banned, my grandfather remembers it as the summer that never ended. Children completed school lessons by correspondence, by listening to broadcasts on the radio. The polio mainly harmed children, with many permanently affected afterwards. Here is a recording from a hospital in New Zealand. Please keep in mind that the language used here is not language we would use today.
Shortwave therapy and other up-to-date techniques have made recoveries speedier and more certain. But the cripples have also to be taught, or retaught, such everyday actions as lifting, holding, and walking. Until full confidence and efficiency have been attained, the cure is incomplete. All types of cripples from all over New Zealand comprise the 73 patients at the home, which is controlled by the Auckland Hospital Board. Many of them are victims of the present polio outbreak.
By 1955, a vaccine was discovered for polio by Jonas Salk. Here is an uplifting broadcast from the time entitled Victory Over Polio, about what the polio vaccine meant for society. One day, this day will come for us too.
A year of anxiety and triumphs. A major medical hurdle was crossed with the discovery by Dr. Jonas Salk of the anti-polio vaccine, which was to spread a mantle of protection over millions of American children. And the scientist entered the ranks of the medical immortals. Leading drug firms shifted into high gear to meet a national demand, which spread to every crossroads despite early controversy. Each hastily set up center became a mecca for anxious parents shepherding little Johnny and little Jill to their inoculations. They're protected, and it didn't hurt a bit.
That was Rachel Simpson with that report. Thank you, Rachel, for putting that together from home. Very, very, what do we take from that, everybody? What do we take from that, and how do we perhaps think about those things this time around? Interesting that they named it a Māori disease back in the day. I think somebody else did that recently. Was that the President of the United States calling it a Chinese virus? Absolutely incorrect.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Yes, indeed. We now have our weekly catch-up with Labour's Andrew Little. Mary Margaret asked him to outline more clearly what we can expect of police patrolling during lockdown, particularly in terms of sufficient dispersal across communities. Just to bear in mind, this audio is not the greatest. We're going to work out how we're going to do that better next week, and I'll try and outline the main points after the interview. She started by asking him how he felt during his first morning in Alert Level 4.
Oh, good, yeah, very quiet. I mean, I managed to get out for a quick bike ride.
Good.
So we'll start to build a bit of routine into these mysterious days ahead of us. So,
will you be working from home or going into Parliament?
No, working from home. No, we've got to do our bit in terms of restricting ourselves, so I've got some work to do, and I'll be in touch with the office throughout the day. So, and things will come up. There may be a need to go in from time to time, for things, but as much as possible, be working from home.
What does the next few weeks look like for you with your work? Is it all based around COVID, or will you keep working on things such as the voter suppression form that you were telling me about last week?
Yeah, none of that stuff goes away, and so there's paperwork associated with that. We also know we've got a general election still scheduled for the 19th of September. We've got referendums attached to that as well. We still have some work to do to get finalised preparations for the referendum, so particularly the cannabis one, so that work will continue. So, yeah, like it won't be all about COVID-19.
Okay, well, moving to COVID-19, I thought you'd be a great person to understand more about what dealing with non-compliance is going to look like. I was listening to Mike Bush on RNZ this morning, and he explained that the first consequence of non-compliance is a warning, and the second may be arrest. How worried are you about the degree of non-compliance that there may be and the extent to which it might jeopardise our efforts?
You know, it's interesting, just in the last couple of days, particularly businesses saying they want to carry on trading through, not really getting that why we're doing what we're doing. We really, you know, the way to stop community transmission is people just got to kind of literally stop in their tracks, stop in their homes. So that didn't give me a huge deal of confidence. That said, I think actually most New Zealanders know what is needed. Many have, you know, they've adjusted and adapted well before midnight last night. Getting around this morning in a 20-minute bike ride, I saw four vehicles. Two of them were trucks, you know, doing work, delivering gas bottles. And then there were two vehicles, who knows what, you know, who they were. But you know, people pretty much have got the message, and we need to. You know, this is about stopping the spread of this virus, because it is out of control, as we've seen in other countries, easily gets out of control. So I have confidence that they will, but I think the police approach is the right one. These early days, people are just going to have to get used to, this is different, you know, this is going to feel different. It's not like the Christmas holidays where you have time off and you get to do a whole heap of stuff. This is like the Christmas holidays and you get to do nothing. You've got to stick at home. So I think the police will take the right approach, but if people are going to be deliberately defiant, then, you know, they're putting all of us at risk, and so they have to be a response to it.
What will the dispersal of police patrol look like? Because in our day-to-day lives, police presence is noticeably unequal across regions and suburbs, but we know that non-compliance is highly likely in, for example, I live in a suburb and I've already heard plans of non-compliance. Is this dispersal of police presence going to change for the enforcement of lockdown?
I think they are tasked with, you know, getting out and about across all communities. And I agree with you. I think there'll be some reasonably comfortable communities who think that they're kind of above it, that they're okay, that they can do what they like. I think one of the critical things, too, is people still adjust to, you know, whether or not they've got enough stuff at home or food and stuff, people still panic buying at supermarkets and the like. So I know that I was down at the supermarket last night. There were police there. There's nothing going wrong, but they were just keeping a presence there, checking things out. And I think you'll see a lot of that. I think they'll be checking on in shopping precincts and things to check who's trading and if it's justified for them to do so. They'll be out and about, and they'll, you know, I think where they, if they see kind of high traffic areas, I think you can expect that cars will be stopped and people just ask what they're doing and where they're going and from maybe at home type of thing. I think that's what we'll see for the next few days at least.
Now, I wondered if you could help us with a clarification on how casual employees are affected by the wage subsidy. I found in the fact sheet that casual employees do qualify, but I had to send that to my boss to make that process begin. It didn't happen automatically. And then I found on Twitter some people have been saying that their bosses have told them that their hours are too few to qualify. Is that is that valid, or is there something going wrong there?
I'm not sure there was an hours limit on it. Basically, an employer applies for a subsidy based on the staff complement that they say they're going to try and they want to keep on board, and that could include casual employees. I mean, strictly speaking, the nature of casual employment is it is kind of day-to-day. You're not guaranteed ongoing employment. That said, if an employer is applying for a subsidy on the basis that your particular role, casual or otherwise, is going to be kept on and subsidised, then they should keep you on, and you should be getting those hours, or at least 80% of those hours, maintained.
The last time that we talked, we weren't even on alert level 2 yet, but I did ask what COVID-19 response looks like inside prison. Now that we're at level 4, what does lockdown look like inside prisons?
Look, I know the Kelvin Davis, who's the Corrections Minister, is across this, and I think the big worry for the prisons is, you know, a whole bunch of people in a confined space, even if they've got different cells, but with a, you know, with a double banking or there's more than one prisoner to a cell, that, you know, that's a high risk sort of thing. So the prisons will be doing everything they can to keep the virus out. That will mean restrictions on visiting, particularly family visitors, and so they'll have to make sure that there's alternatives such as, you know, easy access to phone calls and what have you. Lawyers, obviously, need to continue to be able to visit their clients. I mean, the courts will continue to operate throughout the 4 weeks. So somebody who's been arrested and is due to have their first appearance, they've got to be able to instruct a solicitor, so solicitors have to have access to people. Well, I think the prisons will be, I think they'll be staggering meal times so that they're not having so many people in the dining room at one time and taking those precautions and a lot of keeping services clean and those sorts of things.
To finish, I wondered if you wanted to let us know what your own response was when you woke up this morning and waking up to the reality of such an enormity of what this enforcement is. What do you have to say about it to the listeners?
Yeah, look, this is unprecedented. Nothing like this has ever happened in living memory. And even though my parents lived through the war, and many of us have grandparents and great-grandparents who've been through the Depression and wars and things like that. But this is completely different again, because this is right in our own homes. We're doing something in our own homes, streets, neighbourhoods, cities, towns, the country, that is about dealing with this. And look, we can't even see these things. It's a mysterious thing, you know. It feels kind of weird, and it will feel weird too, because I think the novelty will wear off after a few days, and we've got to get through 4 weeks of this. So the main thing is, you know, stay in contact by phone and other means to people, holler across the street. We've got to maintain that sort of contact. We've got to look after our own mental health.
Mm.
And look out for each other. This is totally about selflessness. It's not about us anymore. It's about everybody else other than us. And I put a Facebook post up last night saying the biggest act of love that we can show for our families, our friends, our neighbours, our communities, our cities and our countries is to stay home and knock this thing out once and for all. We have to do it for everybody and for all of us and for our future.
That was Mary Margaret Slack speaking to Minister Andrew Little. And I just want to cover off some of those main points. Mary Margaret sent these to me actually during the show. Well done, everybody. We're working together. I love this. Okay, so Mary Margaret started by asking how he felt during his first morning, and he actually gone for a bike ride. Didn't know that Andrew Little rides bikes for fun. That's a cool little fact. And he wants to start building a new routine for what he called the mysterious days ahead. He said he'd be working from home as much as possible, but sometimes go into the office, and when asked if his mahi during the rahui would be centred around COVID-19 completely, he said none of his usual ministerial duties go away. So he'll still be working on bills aimed at reforming issues such as cannabis and voter suppression, which he discussed on our show last week. And just, I guess, a note to remember that currently the election is still going ahead in September this year at this point in time. And that means those referendums, one of which is a cannabis referendum, is going ahead. In terms of COVID-19, and Aotearoa Mary Margaret asked the minister if he was worried about how much non-compliance may occur and the extent to which it might jeopardise our efforts. He acknowledged there was some lack of acceptance or understanding for what needed to be done, but that he had faith that most New Zealanders know what they need to do and understand why they have to do it. Mary Margaret's key concern was that the dispersal of patrol might look like, she raised with the minister that in day-to-day life, police presence is noticeably unequal across regions and suburbs, and asked if this will change for the enforcement of lockdown. He acknowledged this to be true and said that police are tasked with getting out across all communities. He reminded Mary Margaret that there will likely be an adjustment period for the first few days, but that we can expect high traffic areas will lead to stopping and questioning. The minister also admitted that he was a bit worried about prisoners during lockdown, but that everything was being done to keep the virus out of prisons. He said cleaning requirements were being ramped up. Restrictions would centre around staggered dining and increasing phone contact, so visiting hours can stop. He reminded Mary Margaret that courts will remain open and explained that because of this, lawyers will be able to visit their clients. And to finish, he reiterated that staying at home was an essential act of aroha.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
That indeed brings us to the end of our show for another week. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. Big thanks to all of those who spoke with us for the show today. Andrew Little, Zoe Kunaitis, Nissan Kata and Stacey Morris. And a thank you to my producers Mary Margaret Slack and Rachel Simpson out there working hard. Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongoana. Thank you to all of you who tuned in and also who got in touch. Thank you for the texts. It's nice to be connected and the phone calls. Ka hoki mai. Well, normally I say that we'll be back next week because I do this once a week, but I'm doing it every day. So I'll see you guys here tomorrow. Same time, same place. You are listening to 95BFM. Stay safe.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.